Welcome to Asia Pacific Defense Reporter, your go-to source for cutting-edge security insights in the region. Get ready for rapid-fire analysis and commentary from the Asia Pacific with your host, Kim Bergman.
Hello and welcome back. I've returned from Korea and I'm now safely in Canberra. And while I was away, focusing mainly on Korean things, I noticed a piece of good news connected with AUKUS Pillar 1, nuclear-powered submarines, and that was that the Wollongong-based company BizAlloy, that produces specialized steels, such as the ones that will be used for the future Redback infantry fighting vehicles, has been awarded a contract in the United States by submarine builder Huntington Ingalls Industries to supply them with some steel for testing and training purposes. Now, the value of the contract was not revealed. I assume that it's quite small, but at least it's progress. It's a sign that an Australian company is getting involved potentially in the US supply chain. Anyway, that just gave me cause to think. What else is Australian industry getting out of AUKUS Pillar 1? Pillar 2, that's a more complex topic because Pillar 2 is a whole lot of, it's a broad range of technologies. Pillar 1 is simple because that's on submarines. Anyway, the government and Defence Industry Minister Pat Conroy in particular are fond of repeating the figure of $30 billion that is going to be spent in Australia. Now, I've not seen a total breakdown of that figure, and in the past, defence has always been reluctant to go into those sorts of details, but I noticed that there's a figure of $8 billion that is going to be spent on HMAS Stirling in Western Australia that's upgrading the facility for the benefit of US and UK submarines that are going to be rotated here from 2027 onwards. Now, $8 billion, I'm sure that the US and the UK are grateful for that. It's their submarines after all. But when we look at where that money is going, it's basically digging holes and pouring concrete because we're strengthening docks and piers and providing the infrastructure that you need for nuclear-powered submarines, which is typically far heavier duty than you need for conventional submarines. So all of that money is going on jackhammers and concrete trucks and stuff like that. Also associated with that, about 1,000 new houses are going to be built in the area. Again, that's pouring concrete and laying bricks. Not to be sneezed at, but there's no real value added there as far as I can tell. Now, that's pretty much the same for Osborne in Adelaide, where the future AUKUS sub is meant to be constructed, if we ever get that far. Now, another $2 billion has been allocated to develop that facility, but again, from what I know about these things, that's $2 billion worth of digging trenches and pouring concrete and a bit of building fabrication. That's already $10 billion out of the $30 billion. And as a nation, I don't see that we're getting anything really for that in terms of improving our industrial base. It might have, you could argue that it has a marginal effect on improving our defence capability, but it's not that we're upskilling. It's not that we're developing new weapons or systems or anything like that. We're just doing the same sort of stuff that is associated with any infrastructure work, like building a highway or building a hospital. Related to that, I saw on the national scene that Prime Minister Albanese has announced that in the May budget, a lot more detail will be forthcoming about a change of economic direction that is going to revive manufacturing in Australia with a focus on future technologies such as green energy. Sounds great. But what this government consistently forgets, along with many preceding ones, is that it's the defence budget that is actually one of the few direct economic levers available to the federal government. Now, from what I can gather, and again, I heard the remarks of Treasurer Jim Chalmers, what the government is thinking of, maybe some small amounts of money like grants and things like that. The rest of it is going to be in the form of tax incentives. I'm a fan of tax incentives, but as for direct investment, it doesn't sound like a lot is going to happen. But on the contrary, the defence budget has billions of dollars. Well, in fact, at the moment, when I look at the defence budget, probably about $25 billion that it is spending on buying new stuff and maintaining the stuff that we already have. That's $25 billion every year. Now, that's a lot of money that can be directed into particular technologies if we choose to do so. It's a powerful lever if used well, as Kim Beazley understood in the mid-1980s, supported fully by Bob Hawke and Paul Keating. After a bit of a gap, Malcolm Turnbull and Christopher Pyne, on the other side of the political fence, had also reached exactly that conclusion in about 2016 and started to reorient the defence budget to take advantage of its ability to put a lot of money into the economy, into selected projects and selected sectors and technologies. But unfortunately, with the departure of those two, that seems to have disappeared. That was a brief 2 or 3 years period of activity. And now the department, the ADF, and the current government sadly seem to have reverted to type with once again a fondness for direct purchases, particularly from the United States. The last podcast was entirely focused on the new general purpose frigate program. And let me update that by saying I am very seriously alarmed the more that I learn about this. And I mean, learn in a relative sense, since the department will not communicate on the topic with the media, not a single word, and has banned all companies likewise from doing so. I've been referring to Project C-3000, which I understand to be the project name, but I think even that is classified. It has got so ridiculous. Anyway, turns out that the situation is far, far worse than I thought even a week ago, because I've learned that it's not only the media that is the subject of this ridiculous level of secrecy, but the companies themselves are also banned from any discussion whatsoever with Australian entities central to all of this, such as CEA for the radar suite, Saab for the 9LV combat system, or Austal for the eventual Australian build. So let me say as simply as possible, this is completely insane. And I might need to pause and have a scream break in a moment, because I've not seen anything quite this bad ever before. This is like saying to a couple, going to 4 or 5 home building companies and saying, well, we've looked at your brochures and we like your four bedroom house with the twin garage. The company says, fine, when do we start? Then they go, hang on, not so fast. We have an electrician who will do all of the wiring, and we have a relative who is a plumber who will do all of that side of things, and we might want a 3-car garage instead of a 2-car garage. Each building company says, okay, we can work with that. Who are these entities? What are their phone numbers? We'll speak to them and see what we can work out between us and come back to you with a quote. But the answer from the couple is, no, you can't do that. We aren't going to give you that information. We just want you to go ahead and quote both on schedule and cost based on what you can guess. Now, this is totally absurd, and no shipbuilder in the world can possibly work like that. But this is the structure that defence and the government seem to have put in place. It's absurd. So we now have 4 or 5 designs, depending on what happens regarding Korea and the cock-up there. I talked about that in last podcast, where the department itself seems to be unaware of whether they want one or two designs from Korea and are unaware that the designs come from different companies in Korea. Anyway, putting all this together means that there are dozens, possibly hundreds, of senior managers and engineers all around the world with these four or five companies speculating about what on earth is going on. Now, nature abhors a vacuum, and bidding for defense projects is the same. In the absence of specific information, people naturally start to calculate, to discuss all sorts of imaginary scenarios. And I've heard, clearly not from the companies themselves, that would be illegal for them to speak with me, but I have heard on the grapevine, so to speak, various theories such as, is this a setup for Japan with potential access to a data pack unavailable to the other bidders? Is all of this a smokescreen so Australia can buy the US Constellation class when the project here falls over? Is it paving the way for Navantia to win because they look to have the most flexible package from what little we know about it? Or is it for the Germans because of the good track record of the MECO design? All of this time and energy of a lot of very smart, very senior people could be far better applied to coming up with a solution for Australia. Instead, because of the way that this program is being managed, or rather mismanaged, people are going round in circles, and it's all because of the stupid way that the DoD, with the blessing of the government, is making such a mess of this. So let's now have a look at how things should be done. The last time Australia acquired a general-purpose frigate was in the late 1980s, and they are known as the Anzac-class frigates. At the time, I was working for the designer Blom & Voss, which then were part of the Thyssen Group, and the decision-making process and the methodology was pretty simple. Navy looked at 12 possible options and reduced that to a short list of two. At the time, the UK pushed very hard for a short list of three, including their Type 23 frigate. But back then, bureaucrats and politicians had a spine. They had worked out the methodology that they preferred, and they were going to stick to it no matter how much external pressure was applied. So there were two finalists, a ship from Germany, an early MECO design, and from the Netherlands, the M-class frigate. Both received funded project definition studies that covered some but not all costs, and they, separate teams, they worked in an interactive way with Defence and Navy to Australianise the two respective designs. The target for Australian industry content was 70%, and the acquisition cost was capped at $3.5 billion for 10 frigates. That was 8 for Australia and 2 for New Zealand. Contract signature with the successful team, Blom & Voss, that was in late 1989. The first Anzac frigate was delivered in 1996. Exactly the same methodology was followed for two subsequent projects, the acquisition of two hydrographic ships and 6 fairly complex high-tech mine hunters. Now, this is how you run acquisitions and then structure projects so that ships are delivered fairly much on time and budget. This was a highly successful template followed in the 1990s. It's a total mystery for me why, well, it's not a total mystery why things have changed. I might go into that in a future podcast. But clearly, we should be capable collectively of learning from the past and doing things properly. By the way, I mentioned the British in the context of the frigate competition. A few years before that, in the mid-80s, they had pushed extremely hard to sell conventional submarines to Australia, the Upholder class. And I mean extremely hard. Diplomatic pressure, the old boy network, the media, lobbying, they did the lot. However, they were rebuffed at all levels because back then the system was run by proud Australians and not the bunch of sellouts that we now seem to have. And in a future podcast, I'll explore what has gone wrong, apart from a general decline in the quality of political leadership and the replacement of patriotism and the national interest with what looks to me like servility and bootlicking. I've mentioned before a new segment called Hotel Kingston Friday Lunchtime Rumours, and they've firmed up a little bit more. That C-1905 deployable mine countermeasures will be cut. C-1408 ANZAC frigate torpedo defence will also be cut. And C-5012 subsurface arrays and various other underwater surveillance systems that will be dramatically reduced in scope. Why? One word. AUKUS. The initial gift of $3 billion out of $4.7 billion to the US looms, and a whole lot of defence programs are being cut and rescoped to pay for that. Now, let me briefly describe an alternate universe. If a different series of decisions had been taken regarding the structure of the future surface fleet, Australia would be taking rapid delivery of missile-firing warships built in Fremantle and delivered in 2026 and onwards. Lursen, this is the company that's doing the Arafura class, a company, I might say, with a proud 130-year history of building warships, offered a version of the C-90 corvettes they're building for Bulgaria, which I'll remind people is a NATO nation. Now, I've been all over the first C-90. It's still under construction, and it's a fine, heavily armed ship. What Lursen was offering for Australia was a larger version, so about 100 metres in length and 2,100 tonnes with excellent range and seakeeping. The version proposed for Australia has about 70% commonality with the Arafuras and would have used the same existing local supply chain. The ships could have had 8-cell vertical launch system, 16 at the outside, a quad pack of naval strike missiles, a 76mm main gun, close-in weapons system, or maybe a rolling airframe missile system, a sonar, and anti-submarine warfare torpedoes. Because of the ease of the redesign effort and switching from Arafuras to the corvette design, the RAN, as I say, could have started receiving these heavily armed warships about 3 years from now. Instead, we will get nothing, and while this idiocy with the general purpose frigate continues, it is likely that we will continue to get nothing. And into the bargain, we have probably offended Peter Lursen, one of the co-owners of the company, because he put a lot of time and effort into the Australian project. I've met him several times, and he is exactly what the Australian naval sector needed. Intelligent, highly experienced, totally committed. What he doesn't know about building warships isn't worth knowing. At a personal level, he doesn't need the work. He's a billionaire. He could retire. He could have retired years ago, but in fact, he's very passionate about what he does, and he is, or I should say at least was, genuinely interested in Australia. And as well as the naval part of the business, the company also builds super yachts, very important part of the business, which puts Peter Lursen in contact with some of the world's most powerful people. He would have been a tremendous asset to Australia generally. And instead, we have driven him off. Well done, defence. Well done, government. Give yourselves a round of applause. Anyway, and on that slightly sour note, with an eye on the clock, I'm sorry that I've got to conclude today's episode, but there's a lot more to come on this. As always, thank you for listening, and see you next time. Bye for now.
That's today's Asia Pacific Defence Reporter. For more in-depth articles, expert opinions, and exclusive interviews, visit asiapacificdefencereporter.com. Stay informed, stay ahead. This is your source for all things defence. Until next time.